I would like to tell you a story. Knife Talk is sponsored by Evenheat, the manufacturers of the finest knife treat ovens available. Find your next heat treat oven at evenheat-kiln.com.
Welcome to episode 75 of Knife Talk. 75, that's crazy. That's crazy. We're here every Monday for you. So today we have myself, Craig Lockwood of Chop Knives. We've got the amazing Mareko Malmasi of Malmasi Fire Arts. And Jeff is back from his European Salsa Tour. Jeff Fader is back. Jeff Fader of Fader Knives. How are you guys?
Tired.
I'm doing good. Actually, I thought they did the tango in Spain.
It's the flamenco. They were doing the flamenco.
Oh, right. Flamenco.
Whatever.
Flamenco.
Whatever you guys want. But it was
sexy dancing.
We saw some flamenco dancing. It was an incredible trip. I cannot thank Tomer and Noam of Florentine Knives for hosting me. Basically, a couple, you know, over the summer, I got a message from Tomer. He wanted to know if I wanted to do a residency. So we worked something out over the winter. He opened up, he said, I got a great idea. Let's do some workshops. And people would come in and he booked the classes. He took care of me, the flights, the accommodations. And I spent a week in his shop, which is an incredible situation. We ate incredible foods. Barcelona is just such a beautiful city. And we taught some great workshops with people from all over. Actually, three of the guys listen to the podcast. Three of the guys who were in the classes, there was Stian from Norway, Ben from Israel, and then there was Peter from Switzerland. They all listened to the podcast. We had two guys from Italy. We had a lot of laughs, but Tomer was an incredible host. He made dinner arrangements for everybody, and everything was like very, very well organized. And it was a really positive experience. And I'm just kind of just buzzing from it. We had a great time. I can't tell you enough about Florentine Knives and their whole package, everything about it. It was a really awesome experience. Mm. Really great.
That's awesome, dude.
And the food looked incredible. The food that you were eating.
The food did look amazing.
Very jealous. He's a smart guy. Tomer is no dummy. He is a smart guy. So he had, for the second workshop, he booked all the cooks from this restaurant called Dos Pebrots, and two peppers. And it was this restaurant that focused on like old school, like Mediterranean, very Roman focused food. It was tapas. We had a tasting menu, and there were some crazy things on. And the cooks cooked for us, and then the next day the cooks came in for the class. So we had a lot of laughs. For me, one of the most exciting and nervous making was the fact that two of the students didn't speak any English. I tell you what, we worked it out. It was a lot of fun, and they had a good time. They were more nervous than I was, and we made it happen. So they had a great time. Everyone had a blast. Everyone walked away with a great knife. Everyone was real happy, and it was a total success. The food is fantastic. You know, Barcelona is one of these, you know, old European cities that's got like a heavy dose of sleaze, which I like. Yeah. You know, it reminds me of the old days in New York City when Times Square was actually a place of, like, you know, there was some, you know, grit and grime and realism, and, you know, a little sleaze is good. So it was just beautiful. It was really beautiful, and the people who work at Florentine Knives are great, Georgia and all the staff back there, and Tomer's wife, Noam, is incredible, and their little son, Lev, was awesome. And, you know, listen, it was as good as, and the thing is, I was very conscious of, you know, the whole thing about guests. You know, guests after 3 days are like fish. They, you know, both of them stink. So I just wanted to make sure that I was a good guest, and we had a lot of laughs, so.
Nice. So tell us about their setup there in Florentine, because I think most of us have seen the pictures online, and it just looks incredibly beautiful. Tell us a bit more about their setup.
They're very, you know what? They're very smart, because they're created a storefront that's also like almost like an expo kitchen, you know, like you can see what's going on. So there's these glass walls and panels and doors, and you can really see, you can walk in and look at knives, but then you can see the workers working on knives, assembling the handles and hand sanding the blades, mm-hmm. and there's a grinding room, and you get a feel for what's going on there. And it's just, it's smart because they have all this stuff, just the right amount of stuff that you need. Everything's very clean. Everything, you know, it's a great way to kind of see what goes on and watch the knives being made. And, you know, it's a very, very smart way to give your customer an idea of, you know, what's going on in here. It's all being fabricated there. And it was, you know, they spent a lot of time and energy in terms of their packaging, in terms of not only the design of their knife, but how they deal with their customers. And I learned a lot from Tomer in regards to just the business end of this business. And I was really impressed with just his whole attitude and tone. I think that he and I both see relatively eye to eye in regards to what direction we want to be going in. And it was great. It was a learning experience, total learning experience.
We talked last week when you weren't here last week. Mareko and I talked about how I bet you're going to learn so much just by spending time with somebody who does something slightly different to what you do. There's so many tips you could pick up from each other.
I pulled up a pile of little things that I really, really liked. And he and I spent a lot of time, and we would go out and we had a few drinks or we'd have something to eat. And we were constantly talking about these little things and what's the value to us and what's the value to our customers and where do we go? Mm. And I helped him and he helped me. And it was really, really great. I'll tell you what I didn't learn. I didn't learn how to make good paella. I had the shittiest paella I ever had in Barcelona. They're not known for their paella, P.S. So, nice. Like, hey, Spain, you got to get it together up there in Barcelona. It ain't known for that. That was some bullshit right there. So, in regards to I didn't learn a damn thing about paella there. That was for sure. But Tomer warned me. He's like, hey, they ain't known for paella over here.
Yeah. Did you get yourself some Florentine knives for yourself?
I actually put one together for Tony, and then I got the parts to him. I didn't have enough time, and I don't want to bug him. And so I got, he graciously gave one, a small paring knife for my daughter, Lila, and engraved her name on it, which was real nice. And I will try to kind of get her into cooking. I was kind of thinking that this is something that she could have for a while and, you know, get her fired up about cooking. And then I got the parts to put one together for myself. So it was great. It was really cool. I really liked his whole stack handle. I don't think anybody does anything quite like it. And he's got these really, really good transitions on how he makes his knives. He focuses on the simplicity of the transitions. He focuses on good geometry, just a stunning look. I'm a huge admirer of Tomer. And actually, the first time I'd ever heard of him is when you interviewed him back in the day. So there's in the archives, you look up Florentine Knives, Craig did an awesome interview with Tomer. It was definitely something that I learned a lot from. But he's a stunning guy, man. He and his wife are really, 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 really smart. Very
and
smart.
It's still my go-to knife. My Florentine chef knife is still my go-to knife in the kitchen.
Well, I'm fired up to give it, you know, put it one together and give it a whirl. So we had a good time. It was their 1 year anniversary in Barcelona. They had a little party. That was a lot of fun. And, you know, I got to meet some people in Barcelona and just, you know, it was great. My wife and kid tagged along for a little bit of it, and that was fun. And we were kind of ships of the night, but they got to see a lot of Europe and not a lot of Europe. But they went to go see some cities. And, you know, my daughter's now getting to the age where the school system is not the greatest. So we kind of focus on saving our money for travel, and she gets to see, you know, more than just our little town, and she appreciates it. And it was a great trip.
Nice.
That's awesome, dude.
And I'm sure we're going to learn more about your trip throughout today's episode.
What about
you, Mareko? What about you? What have you been up to, Mareko?
So that knife that I had last week that I was a little concerned about the pattern, I sent a picture to the customer and let them know where things were at. And they were into it.
Oh, there
so
we go.
I've just been plugging away. So a little bit, nothing tragic there, fortunately, because I already had the setback of the Damascus. So I've just been plugging away at getting that ground and kind of prepped. I've also, actually yesterday, and then I will be continuing today, I'll be doing some filming with Neil Kamimura. He's actually up here. We did some forging yesterday for SMB footage. And today it's going to be all about grinding. We're kind of doing some how-to content for combat.
Nice.
About how I approach grinding blades, how I approach handle sculpting, and how I really kind of I think it'll be cool to spend some time kind of talking about and demonstrating how I articulate and make use of the belt to really get a lot of contour activity in my handles. Just the way that I like them. Mm. Jeff's seen them. They get really curvy in there. And go ahead.
Sorry, where will this footage be? Will it be on Combat site or is it going to be YouTube stuff? What's it for?
I mean, I think it's going to be hosted or living on YouTube, but I'm sure you can find it on Combat site. I'll be posting up on my site as well as links to it on my Instagram once everything gets put together. Cool. It'll probably still be a little bit, but yeah. What we got here is somebody taking raw footage and then Combat's going to go through and do some editing and put it together, and it's going to be good. I think it's going to be really good. So that's basically what I've been doing, is kind of getting ready for Neil to be here and also just kind of tidying up and cleaning up around the shop. It's been some incentive to tidy up my rat's nest that I had building up in the corner where I have my workbench. I'm the worst about moving out of boxes when I move. And so I was just like slowly just digging through my boxes when I needed something for a knife that I was working on. So now Neil's here and I was like, shit, I got to get this all cleaned up. So I cleaned it all up. And so I spent time getting ready for him for this. And that's it. That's basically what I've been up to this last week.
That's super cool. That's super cool that he's doing a tour and coming down to film with you and Luis. That's going to be a lot. I'm looking forward to seeing that. So it's going to be, the video is going to be at Combat Erasives or?
Yeah, so it's going to be, I'm sure they'll have it embedded on their website. Right. They'll have links to it on their Instagram. They'll have it on their YouTube. They have a YouTube channel, and I'll do the same. I'll have it on my YouTube. Same thing.
Awesome. Website. That's going to be great. I look forward to seeing it. That'll be really cool to see you guys cranking something out. Craigie Pie, what's going on? I'll tell you one thing that happened last week that with you is you blew us off down in Barcelona.
It's been crazy. So I was so looking forward to coming over to meet you and to meet Toma and see the shop and everything else, but everything just got on top of me. So I've had a few orders this last month. I mean, I've talked about this in the past where my wife was in India, so I was living in the UK with the kids and just trying to get through orders. So last week, I got my nephew came over with me and he was helping me out in the shop. And we had a week of just 12 hours a day, no real distractions and just cranking through work. So then last Monday, we flew back into the UK. And since then, I've just been basically on the road. So I had to deliver a bunch of knives right up to the north of the country. And I've been in and out of London twice this week. It's just been non-stop. So, so we had a big, big rush job last week to get a big batch of knives finished. Those are now finally delivered. And I said, it's just been meeting after meeting. So it's been planes, trains and automobiles all week. And I am pooped. Absolutely pooped. So
that's good.
We fly back to France tonight. We leave about 2 a.m. to get to the airport. And tomorrow in France, so this is going live on Monday, but Sunday, recording Saturday, sorry. So on Sunday is Bastille Day, which is the French sort of Independence Day. It's a massive day in France. Mm. So we arrive 9 a.m. in France. We don't want to go straight to bed. We want to make the most of all the festivities and there's all this stuff going on. So come Monday, I think I'm going to be a man who could sleep for a week. I'm pretty sure of it. But it's all worth it. It's all worth it. So yeah, I've got to see a lot of the UK today, this week, that I haven't seen before. Met some amazing chefs working on some really, really nice projects. It's been one of those weeks of just, in and out and just, getting everything in line, really ready to make some more knives.
And P.S. American listeners, we have it not as good as the Europeans in terms of air travel. I did not know how cheap it is to fly around Europe.
It's ridiculous.
When you hear Craig talking about he's jet setting all over the place, the prices of flying throughout Europe, it's cheaper than a bus ticket.
Yeah.
It's a little annoying, to be honest with you. Because
get from France to the UK for about $9.99. As in
€9.
Yeah, which is rounded.
What? €9, yeah.
Which is near enough $9.
It is infuriating.
Are you kidding me?
No, that's my flight price. But here's the thing, and this was going to be my beef, for I've got a second one lined up just in case. the travel, the last mile, as I call it, so from the airport to the house or wherever it may be, that's the bit that's expensive. So the train, for example, from Cardiff, which is in Wales, to London, can cost like £150. But I can jump on a plane and get all the way to France for like less than £10. It's bonkers. Bonkers.
It's bonkers. It's totally bonkers. And this is the reason why when we had the class, people were flying from all over the place. Italy and Switzerland and England. And there was two guys there was another guy from Norway. And I was just like, Jesus Christ, where do these guys have all this money? We got some rich people flying from all over the place. And then Tomer said to me, no. It's super cheap. And that's the reason why I was so irritated with you, Craig, because you were supposed to come down to Barcelona and you were like, is he coming? Is he not coming? And Tomer's like, he doesn't make a decision yet. I'm like, how does he get, in the United States, you can't just show up to the airport and buy a plane ticket unless you want to pay a grand. Oh, there, you show up, it's like you're hailing a taxi cab. It's so infuriating.
Many budget airlines, and these budget airlines, they're undercutting each other all of the time. And I'm pretty sure it can't be profitable for them, because I've been on flights where I've paid sort of €10 for the flight, and it's only half full. And I know it's terrible for planet, and I know that weighs on my conscience a lot when I fly a lot. But I think I'm going to go for the cheaper cost every time.
Well, there you go. Doesn't weigh that hard on you. Obviously, you feel bad for a second, and then you hop on that plane and put your feet up. That's what you do.
Well, I'm hopping on the plane anyway. So whether I spend £300 or £10 on the flight, it makes no difference to myself.
So Americans, don't think that these, here's the one thing. One thing that's great about it is it encourages people in Europe to travel and see other parts of the country. There was one of the cooks, he lives, his family was from Ireland. So he gets a couple days off. He hops on the plane to go to Ireland for nothing, for literally nothing. And we're not exaggerating. Tomer was telling me it's like you can almost fly for free.
Yeah.
And it's great. We can't do that here. To go down to Florida, you're looking at least $500.
Unless it's school holiday time. But it's school holiday times, they skyrocket the prices.
I'm not crying for you, Craig. I'm not crying for you. I'm the worst at finding air travel because I hate having to find the cheaper price. And then you get up on this plane that you don't get this, you don't get that. It's like, it sucks.
Yeah. But it's one of those things. It's nice to be able to travel, but like I said, it's the last mile. Great. That's where all cost comes in.
Poor Craigie Wag and his little train. My train's too expensive. All right. So, with all this fun and games, we come to some, unfortunate news. I'm going to transition into serious, serious conversation. We've had some unfortunate news. I hate to be, coming hard, but these are some trying times. So, Mareko, you have a little bit of something to talk about, don't you?
Yeah. So, Tim Hancock, who is an incredible knife maker, super talented. He's somebody who a lot of folks look to as a great example for like dog bone buoy handle or dog bone buoys, and an amazing level of execution, quality, and attention to detail. He just passed away these past few days, and he's been an incredible mentor to some of the most talented American makers that we have the fortune of knowing, like Mike Quisenberry and Mike Tyree, Travis Wirtz, Josh Smith. And I only know of him. I never had the opportunity to meet him. He came down with Parkinson's quite a few years back, and then it kept him from being able to make knives, and so he kind of pulled away from the community a little bit in that way, and so he hasn't really been part of it, and ultimately it was what took his life. And but from what I understand, he was an incredible guy, very very kind, very gracious, very thoughtful when he would look at people's work, and just give some really great feedback. And Josh Smith had some really nice words that he posted on his Instagram that I want to share. He says, "Tim Hancock was a mentor to me and so many others. He was an amazingly talented knife maker. Tim was an accomplished explorer on the back of a mule and a couple packed behind him. I was lucky to develop a close friendship with Tim and spend time in his home and also have him in mine many times. Tim's career was cut tragically short by Parkinson's disease. Tim was one of the largest influences on my knife making skills. I use his techniques every single day I make knives. I will always be thankful for what he taught me, and even more thankful that I got to call him a friend. Rest in peace, Tim. So it's got me all choked up, actually, a little bit. I mean, it's
very sad, and
he was a thought to his family and friends. It's a terrible
absolutely.
Thing.
I know, absolutely. I know that the first time I'd ever heard of him was from Nick Wheeler. Nick Wheeler would talk about Tim Hancock quite often. And look, you know, it was an incredible wealth of information to a lot of people, inspired a lot of people, and there's something to be said about that. You know, it's something to be said about being able to, you know, inspire people, and he's going to live on with other people, and, you know, passing all that information along is fantastic. So maybe he lived life was cut short, but he lived a full life and he was cared for, and people, you know, he helped a lot of people, and that's something to be said.
Obviously well-respected by the community. And
Of course. Well, it's very tragic, and, you know, we're with you. I mean, it's sad, and we're obviously grateful for his contributions to a, you know, a very important field.
Absolutely.
Okay, so we've been asking you some questions, and this is part of the show we like to call, "Hey Man, Can I Ask You a Question?"
Hey, man, can I ask you a question?
All right, so here we are. The first question comes from MaxGear319, and he writes, "I'm a small guy without hardly any fancy tools, and I have to make shift most of what I use. I feel it builds a better smith to start out with less and still produce great blades versus someone who jumps in and magically has all these great tools and a bit less talent. Would you agree? Thanks, guys. You rock." So basically he's saying he has minimal tools, and he thinks that there's some sort of value to that. What's your opinion, guys?
I think if you're starting from, you know, starting from scratch, the tools that you've got, you'll learn to appreciate, and you'll spend a lot of time sort of mastering those tools. Whereas if you were to go out and spend, you know, 50 grand on a brand new shop with everything you need, you're never going to be able to sort of spend that time with each machine and learn its little quirks and so on. So there's definitely a value to that. But I also think, I mean, there's a lot of sort of people gear bashing, people who say, you know, oh, well, you've got that, so, you know, it's easy for you. You know, and I don't think that's the case either. But I think whatever works for you, and, you know, personally, I could always do with an extra machine, you know, no matter what it is. I've always got an extra machine on my list ready to be bought. But yeah, there's definitely a value in starting with very little and having that time with each machine or tool that you have to learn is, you know, is excess. I'm not even going to try that word. To learn
eccentricities.
That's the one. I tell you what, baby. Last week we had Chatoyans, and we've got eccentricities this week.
Go ahead.
High level podcast.
Yeah,
there's definitely a value to spending time with each tool and getting to learn it.
What do you think? What do you think, Mareko?
I think it's just in general, if in anything that you want to do in life, is unless you really, really can afford for it to go out the window, like you just went and got a burger and decided that you didn't like it and just threw the rest of it away. I think it's better to start slow rather than diving in headfirst and, like Craig said, investing a ton of money in all of the gear and equipment that you need or most ideally have and use to make knives. I think it also gives you an opportunity by starting a little more humbly to have to learn a lot of very solid foundational skills about patience, actually more than anything, patience and taking the time to do things well the first time, doing them by hand with simple hand tools, and then graduating, because ultimately it's doing that kind of rough work that will really help you decide, you know, is this something I really want to do? Do I want to take this full time? Do I want, or am I good and I'm ready to move on to the next thing? I just think starting simpler more than anything is just a good idea in general.
I get the feeling that he's basically saying it's more virtuous to start out with less. And I tend to disagree. I tend to disagree in terms of the idea of, in terms of the idea of like, well, he has this and I don't have that. And I'm more talented with less. And this guy magically has this thing and he's not as good. I tend to think that in this field a lot, and we dealing with like other knife makers and dealing with customers, I think we need to stop focusing on what other people are doing and start focusing on it. It doesn't really matter. If at the end of the day, if you get the job done, you get the job done. And I think that, yes, as a, you know, I started out, you know, by, you know, when you're a blacksmith, you end up making a lot of shit that you don't have. There's a lot of times where you're unable to, you know, afford certain things and you have to kind of make do with what you have. Guys using train spike or using train tracks for anvils. You do whatever it takes. And there is a value to being able to be a problem solver. There's a value to being able to figure out, well, listen, I can't afford this now, but someday I will. But I think that when we get to the point where when my kid was as on the swim team, I used to beg her, whatever you do when you're swimming in a race, don't look over to the other guy or the other person swimming. And she says, why? And I said, because the statistics are when I watch people and the kids are looking at the other swimmers, they always lose. So I think we need to kind of focus on our own journey. And there are certain things that are just going to take away. The certain things are going to take away your problem. I mean, like, listen, we can start off with a file. But if I had a 2x72 grinder, I'm going to cut out a lot. I'm going to be more efficient in what I'm doing.
Definitely.
You know, I think that we worry too much about this. You know, there's no medal for virtue in regards to how you're doing it. If you do something, no one you know, that's the thing about when we talk about, when I talk about my complaints about the art world. Ultimately, it's the final outcome. It doesn't really matter how you do it. Nobody looks at a piece of art in the wall and says, oh, well, this is how he did it, and it makes it more valuable. Ultimately, it's the final outcome. So whether or not you're doing it with minimal tools or maximum tools, ultimately, I don't even think it cares. It doesn't matter to me at all. Or your customers.
Yeah.
Your customers, unless you're just like, well, you know, this is the whole point of this knife is that I only use rock salt and, you know, a couple twigs and a pine cone. All right. Well, now all of a sudden it's very interesting. But at the same time, it's like, I don't worry about what the next guy does. It doesn't have anything to do with me.
Yeah.
Swim your own race.
There you go.
There we go.
Hey, baby.
Yeah. I like it.
I'm with you.
All right. This next one is from Gabe Jensen 09. Says, since you all work for yourselves, are you guys doing anything for a retirement plan, or are you not planning on retirement?
I think this is for you specifically, Jeff. Being the oldest, you need to start worrying about this kind of shit, I think.
Amen. Yeah. Amen. Amen. Now we're going into smartest, because my wife and I started a retirement plan a long time ago, just because we wanted to save money for my daughter to go to college. We're by hook and by crook, we're going to get there, and we've been putting away money. So when we get to the point where we're going to retire, we have a little bit of dough. Now, based on my history, as in my family, my father worked until he couldn't work anymore. There's no way I'm going to be sitting in a lounge chair drinking a margarita, waiting for the sun to set and watching, you know, the Golden Girls. That ain't happening. I'm going to be walking around making shit until the day my day is done. Yeah. So, but I have a little bit of money to, you know, hopefully to, whether or not it's for me or if I can pass it on to my daughter. Yes, the answer is yes. So I'm looking towards my future in a positive manner. So there you go. Mm. How about you, Craigo?
I don't have anything formal. Well, so I suppose property, you know, buying property, and that's, you know, that's going to be sold eventually, that kind of thing.
Sure.
My wife's 10 years younger than me, so hey, she can continue working while I'm sitting in a rocking chair.
Nice. There you go. That's a good plan.
That's a joke. Listen. That's a joke. She would kill me if she heard that. She would kill me. No, it is something that plays on my mind, actually, because I've got nothing formal. I've always worked for myself, never really worked for anybody else apart from a very short period. So it's always been up to me. And pretty much like you said, Jeff, I can't see myself not making stuff until the day I die. But the time is ticking on, and you know, I'm 42. I'm no spring chicken, so it is something FYI, that I need to take more seriously.
FYI, if you put money away in a retirement plan, that reduces. I mean, sorry to sound like we're talking. This is like accountant talk, but I mean, you do pay less in taxes.
Grandpa talk.
Yeah,
you pay flex. I mean, it is. You are saving money because if you're putting a certain amount of money away, you're paying less in taxes every year. So it's like that's not like, you know, it's better. You know, you're paying taxes on less income because you put that money in your retirement. So you're actually making a little bit of cash.
I think it's actually different in the UK and Europe. It is to the US as well, where we actually pay something called national insurance, which goes towards a sort of state pension, that kind of thing. And particularly in France, it's a lot more generous than it is in the UK. But this reminds me of a story, something I saw this week. So it's Father's Day coming up in the UK. I think it's next Sunday, I think. I was reading this magazine. There's an advert for it, and it was a nursing home. And this advert was, Father's Day is coming up. You know, you need some respite care. Why not put your father into a home? And here's a special promo code for Father's Day. It's just like,
Oh my God.
That's fantastic. What?
Amazing.
When are you going to do it? For Christmas? I mean, when are you going to run that ad?
Happy Father's Day, Dad. You're going into a home.
It seems somebody's like, that makes a lot of sense. What are we going to do? Valentine's Day? If you love them that much, put them in a home. What are you going to do? You got to figure out some time to spring that promo code.
Crazy.
You know?
Crazy.
There you go.
At $1,500 a week. Crazy money.
There you go.
What about you, Mareko? Do you have any sort of retirement plans or any sort of...
My wife is much better at the money side of things, but she's very good at saving, and we do have, she has set up some sort of retirement situation for us so that we're going to be good. And also, in addition to just my own health insurance, we also have life insurance, you know, just in case the very worst happens. Working in the shop, because obviously we know it does happen.
Yeah.
And so, yeah.
Yeah.
So that's another thing to think about.
And again, that's a big difference between sort of Europe and the US, you know, healthcare, life insurance, that kind of thing. It's, you know, in the UK, you're pretty much set for the time being. How long this will last, we don't know. But, you know, if you were to be in an accident, you're going to be taken care of, you know, cost free. Whereas I know for you guys in the US, it can be crazy, crazy.
Generally, when you deal with this stuff when you have kids, so a lot of the times it has to do with like, well, what are we going to do? We're going to talk about, what else are we going to talk about? I mean, this is some bullshit. Come on, man. Let's get into fucking knife talk. We don't need to talk about retirement talk.
Accountancy
These people
news.
Don't care about our, they don't care about our fucking problems like this. Come on, let's get going. Hey, listen to me. Listen to me, Gabe Jensen. Don't worry about it. We're all squared away, and so are you. Let's get to the next question.
BMLK802 asks, do you think about your legacy? If so, what do you want to be remembered for, either as a functional artist or as a human?
Deep. Ooh, I like that one. That's Deep. A good one. Go ahead.
Mareko, why don't you kick us off?
Okay. From time to time I think about it. And that's, you know, that's part of what I'm trying to do more. Or why I'm trying to do more meaningful, like how-to content. You know, I do really quick, like stuff on my Instagram, just showing a little tidbits. But I would really like to go deeper to really help people, because it's hard to offer classes unless you either have a lot of experience at that, you're really good at it, or you have the setup. And I don't really have any of those things. So the best I can do is try to just put it out there to help other people. Because ultimately at the end of everything, like, what do you got, but how you treated other people in the world and the people that you love and care about. And so, you know, I folks get upset with me for not being more stingy, I guess, with the stuff I know and do, but you know, if I'm gone tomorrow, what good is any of that? So yeah, I guess I do think about my legacy.
Being helpful is a very noble thing. You know, being helpful is very noble.
Yeah. I think with regards to legacy, I don't really think of my work in that case, because you know, what we're doing, we're not changing the world with our knives. But I just think, like you said, you know, being, you know, that human that you want to be. And, you know, I think we've all got somebody in our life that, you know, were a big sort of influence on us. And for me, it was my grandfather. And, you know, every decision I make is like, you know, would he approve of this kind of thing? And I just think, you know, being that sort of person where, especially now having kids, that, you know, they can look up as they grow older, I want to be their hero. You know, I think that's the sort of legacy that I think about, more than work. I don't really think of any sort of, you know, I'd love to see my knives being used, you know, in 60, 70 years time somewhere. And, you know, for future generations to be using my knives, but that...
You'll be dead.
I'll be dead. That's not my driver, really.
Yeah. I think that's a very smart thing to say, because I like this question, and I thought about it, and honestly, my legacy is I want to work like a dog, so maybe 1 month I will have a little bit extra money that we can kind of knock out a little bit more of our mortgage. I want to be able to make money that my daughter's not going to have to be straddled with a pile of loans for college. Maybe make enough money that I can give her a little bit of money, so when she starts her life out, I can help her with a down payment of a house. These are the issues that I think about every day. I don't think about, you know, future generations at all. I could give a shit about the unborn future dead, you know, the future unborn customers of mine. I could care less. I'm interested in taking care of, you know, trying to make my family's life a little bit better. And that's really kind of my 100% driving goal. And in regards to my knives, the only thing I want people to think is I'm giving them value. And I'm standing behind my work, and that's it. I don't really care about them handing. I don't really, that whole handing down the generations thing. It's like, I'm going to be dead. What do I care? When I had my appendix out and they put me out, when I woke up, I realized death is not going to be that awful. It's not like we're going to be sitting on a cloud twiddling our thumbs. You know, I think that, you know, I'm not going to be worrying about, you know, that stuff back down the line. And I think that the legacy is, you know, the legacy is now. It's like how I'm helping my direct family.
Hmm.
So
this is
a
deep and serious episode. This is
damn right.
Shush,
shush. Onward. All right. This next one comes from. Now we're back to knife talk. Before it was lawyer talk or accountant talk. Now we're back to knife talk. All right. This comes from a strange event. Hey man, can I ask you a question? I'm just getting ready to heat treat my first forged knife, and I have a question about soaking. I'm wondering what soaking will do at various stages of the heat treat. Love the show, and hello from Nova Scotia. So when we talk about soaking, we're talking about heat treatment. What do you guys think?
I found with different steels, it can make a huge difference. So when I first started, I was using 01 a lot. And I was doing my heat treat in this little forge that I had, this little devil forge, and it was terrible. But yeah, I was fortunate enough to be able to, you know, be able to have the use of a tester, a hardness tester. And with 01, I mean, most of the recommendations that you see online and in the technical sheets and so on, they all say sort of 5-10 minute soak and that kind of thing. But I was finding, for example, you know, with 01, I was finding a 20-minute soak was far better. Now, I don't know why, I don't know about, you know, the chemical compositions and what was happening scientifically there. But I seem to have just a harder blade. And I'm sure one of you guys will be able to tell us what was happening during the time of the soak. But yeah, I just think if you can find the technical specs of your, you know, the technical heat treating specifications, just play with it a bit, you know, soak a little bit more, soak a bit less, and just see what works for you.
Yeah. In my experience, soaking the material, excuse me, is important at various, even in temper stages. You know, you don't want to just, I mean, if you're in a pinch and you got a torch temper and blade, then you got a torch temper blade. But ideally, obviously, you want to get it at least a good couple cycles at, you know, if you're trying to keep it harder than maybe a 350 versus a harder working knife, which is more, maybe we're on 425 or 450. But you need those soak times to really get that heat evenly distributed, or I guess to evenly affect the entire blade. But when it comes to soak times and hardening, it does depend on what kind of steel you're working with. One potential, actually reason, Craig, that you were getting harder blades from a longer soak is that once your steel comes to critical, and I don't know what the temperature, if you are soaking right at critical, which is maybe 1500, 1550 or something like that. But once it reaches that temperature and then it's soaking for a long time at higher temperatures, that grain starts to grow, which is obviously not necessarily the greatest thing. And large grain will yield, kind of a false positive. Yes, you'll get a hard ass knife, but you'll also get a very brittle knife. And if you want to go for a longer soak with higher carbon steels or higher alloy steels, high carbon steels, then kind of a better way to go is lower temperatures for longer. So eventually, even it'll take longer for everything to go into full austenite, but you're less likely to accumulate large grain growth in higher, like those higher alloy steels. And I guess you'll get the full hardness, the high hardness that you want without potentially overgrowing that grain. But with more conventional high carbon steels, especially 10 series, 1075, 1080, 1095, you don't need much of a soak. Because they don't have all the crazy alloying elements and stuff in them. And so, you know, 5 minutes once it's at critical temperature. So what I usually with in my even heat kiln is I bring the kiln up to temperature. I let it cycle down and kind of even out. And then I put my blade in and then I let the kiln come back up to temperature. And after I give it first like 5-10 minutes to just come up to temperature. And then once it's at temperature, then I let it soak for another 5 minutes. So it's probably a total of probably gets the temperature and it has my soak at about 15 minutes. So actually at 20 minutes, Craig, if that's what you were doing, similar thing, your blade was actually probably fine. So okay. I wouldn't be concerned about grain growth. But if you had brought it up to critical and then let it soak for another additional 20 minutes at 1500, 1550, or even higher temperatures, then I would be concerned of the grain getting kind of out of control. Because it grows pretty aggressively with time, for
there
sure.
There we go. There's the science lesson we were looking for.
Well, I tell you what, that's an excellent. That whole grain growth story was excellent. And I actually, when I read this question ahead of time, I actually wanted to get a different voice, so I sent a message to our friend Jonathan Porter at Doghouse Forge, and I asked him about his opinion about soaking, the concept of soaking. So what he wrote to me was, soaking allows time for the work pieces to evenly distribute temperature through the thickness. He says, think of cooking a steak. The grill might be 500 degrees, but even after cooking for 10 minutes, the center of the steak is still only 120 degrees. So that whole concept of soaking is you're kind of normalizing that temperature. When I was in culinary school, when they discussed how an oven works, it's an exchange of temperatures. So you have a hot oven and you have a cold, whatever you're putting in, and you're actually, when you put that cold piece of whatever into the oven, you're actually exchanging the temperature. So the oven goes down in temperature, and then the whatever you're putting in goes up. So it's an exchange of heat. So that soaking time is really about normalizing that temperature all the way through.
Mm-hmm. Cool.
Makes sense. There you go. Yeah. A little technical. Got it all.
Yeah. All right. This next one is from Diamond Metalworks. He says, hey, man. Do your wives listen to the podcast? Do you guys' wives listen to the podcast?
No.
I know she does sometimes because she'll refer to things that have been said, but I don't think it's on her top 10 list of things to do in a week.
No, my wife is not interested in grain growth at all. She gets enough of my shit anyway. She's just like, what do I got? I got to listen to you on tape? Come on, give me a break. You had it.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, astonishingly, my wife does listen to the podcast. And it's astonishing in the way that I'm always talking about knife making in the first place. And then she still listens to the podcast. So I sweetheart, thank you so much for listening. Appreciate the support.
Wow.
Now let's give a shout out. We need to review on iTunes.
Yeah. Come on. You listen so much. You're with you. We're with you. Mareko's wife. Welcome aboard. Thank you for being so supportive. Sarah. Thank you very much. I appreciate it. All the best.
Triple H Ironworks asks, hey, Cutie, can I ask you a question? What was the dumbest financial decision that you've made as a beginner?
That's a good one. That's a good one.
I'll kick things off. My dumbest financial decision was buying the cheapest stuff I could get. So with regards to, you know, a drill press, I bought a cheap grinder, a little 1x30 grinder. It got me going, but the difference when I sort of stepped up and bought, you know, quality equipment, the difference was just exponential. It was just crazy. So yeah, so make those buy-in decisions quite carefully and don't sort of scrimp on the essentials.
That's a good one.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, you don't know. You think you know until you know.
Yeah, that's the thing.
I've never, every time I've spent a little bit extra money on my oven, my even heat oven or a grinder, I always think, why did I wait so long? Mm. And then I get angry because I thought, I'll be okay with this, you know, Ryobi, you know, nonsense. You know, I'll be okay with this until I can figure it out. And then every time I get something better, I'm just like, I was so stupid. Why did I wait so long?
Yeah, I mean, I've had the similar situation that you had, Jeff. But I think another thing that I've done is I get it built up in my head when I'm looking at, like, handle material or, you know, like Corby. Like, I had a batch of special Corby bolts made from bronze. And, you know, I had to do a minimum purchase of, like, 200 bolts. And I was like, yeah, I'll use all those. And, or just like steel, like getting a bunch of steel and be like, yeah, I'll use that. And it's just laying around. Like, it's stuff that I'll probably eventually get to it, but I'll actually more likely sell it to somebody else before I actually use it. So I guess it's buying more than I actually need at that time. It's 'cause I'm dumb, I guess.
That's a good question. That was a good question.
Yeah. All right. So talking about money, you're not going to make a mistake, actually, if you go to combatabrasives.com, because they got a 10% discount code it's KnifeTalk10 at combatabrasives.com, and that'll save you 10% on anything that you buy from them, whether it's their handle material, their epoxies. They got all kinds of crazy abrasives in all kinds of forms and formats, from the they obviously have belts, but they also have, they actually have buffing compounds and buffing wheels, and they got all kinds of stuff for you. They got discs. So whatever you need, especially when it comes to abrasives on your machines, especially your grinding belts, those shredders are incredible. Go to combatabrasives.com, punch in Knife Talk 10, and then and you'll save yourself 10%. And don't forget to tag yourself. Don't forget to tag us when you get a hold of your combat and show us what you're making with it. We want to share you back out, and combat will want to put you on blast too. So definitely make sure to give us all a tag and have fun and work smart more than anything.
And they rushed me out some belts. Those braces are awesome. Garrett rushed me out some belts to take to Barcelona, and they came out great. So thank you so much. Combat's been awesome. Nice. Thank you so much.
Yeah.
All right. This one comes from JPH. I've been trying to forge as close to possible the final dimension. I'm not happy with the surface finish I'm getting. I wipe any scale off my anvil between heats, and I've used water on the anvil to pop the scale off the blade. And as far as I can tell, my forging has a reducing atmosphere. Should I take low heats to planish the steel after forging, or should I minimize the exposure to air by taking shorter or fewer heats? I tend to spend a lot of time tweaking and straightening. Hmm. There you go. What do you think, Mareko?
Well, when I'm forging, I do my tweaking and straightening at lower temperatures, and when I'm saying lower, I'm talking like subcritical, but definitely with color in it. So like a dull red to a dull orange, but nothing hotter than what you would be heat treating at, basically. But and part of the reason is because I'm not trying to do excessive mass reduction or moving. I'm not trying to actually forge. I'm just straightening things out and kind of tapping things. But for me, I mean, really, actually, I think when it comes to scale reduction, getting a better, cleaner surface, you're definitely a good resource for that, Jeff, with your blacksmithing background. But I've never been good with that whole water on the anvil popping off the scale.
Me neither.
I just kind of try to. Yeah,
it's
yeah.
Weird.
I've seen it done a few times, and it's cool. But I think it works. I don't know. I've never really done it. But more than anything, I just try to forge really evenly, and definitely in the last few rounds at lower temperatures to help kind of blast off or bust off some of that Ford scale, and you know, lower temperatures at kind of shorter periods. You know, when I'm doing the straightening stuff and tidying up, I'm just bobbing in and out of forge, and I'm hitting the knife like every couple minutes as I put just a little bit more heat in it. So, and I'm not forging to, you know, or like straightening and stuff until black. You know, I do a couple hits, take a look at it, put it back in the forge, and just bob in and out. And so, I don't know. That's what I got. But
well,
what about you,
well,
Mr. Blacksmith?
When you're heating the steel up, the hotter it gets, the more, you know, the carbon's going on the outside and you're developing the scale. One thing I've learned recently in the past 5 years working with John Ariani, Cliff Dufton, and all those guys is they're constantly wire brushing before the steel goes back into the forge. And what that does is that gets rid of the scale, so the next time you forge, you're not actually driving the scale into the knife. So one of the things these guys do is they do a ton of brushing, like aggressive brushing with these big old brushes. It's a little bit ridiculous as far as I'm concerned. I'm just kidding. It's fine. Go ahead. Live your life. The other thing is that's true. If you're forging at a lower temperature, you're pulling the steel at a lower temperature, you're going to get a lot less forge scale. And then when you're forging, you're going to be driving a little bit more material in a flatter way, a straighter way without as much scale. I don't do that. I'm a bit of a maniac. I do a little bit. If I see excess scale, I usually take it off. I could be a little bit tidier when in between heats and making sure that I don't have any scale on the anvil face. I just, you know, I have my own problems I need to deal with. But a lot of times, a lot of these guys really spend a lot of time descaling the knife or the steel before they put it back in. And I think that you'll get a little bit of a better situation. Also, I hate to say it, but a lot of people's anvils, the faces of their anvils are pretty fucked up. So if you have an anvil face if you have an anvil face that has got, it's chewed up or it's been sitting outside and it's pitted and rusty, when you hit whatever you're hitting, when you hit your knife or whatever you're forging, you're actually driving the material into those like cracks and stuff. That's why a clean face is super important. And it's because you're not going to embed the crack, you're not going to embed, you know, the pitting into whatever you're forging.
Pitted, bro. So pitted.
Nice. That's an isolator. You got to isolate that one. That's a good one right there.
Have you not seen that surfer in California?
I certainly have. I love that. That little clip is so great.
Pitted.
That is a good clip.
Pitted, bro.
Pitted, bro. So pitted. I love it.
Actually something that you can do. So what's great about, and I think what makes that water on the anvil technique work is that it shocks the surface, this water and this hot ass steel. And it's something that, I mean, I'm sure you guys have observed this in oil quenching, is that any kind of scale that develops on the outside of the blade when you're doing an oil quench blasts off from the shock of being quenched. And something that I've done before with like blacksmith knives is I'll have like a container of canola oil, usually it's like in a little metal cylinder next to the forge. And if you just do like a par quench, so you're not full quenching all the way down to room temperature, you know, you're pulling it out around critical, maybe just below critical, and quenching it just to black. You know, you don't need it to go farther than that, but that shock will blast off also that forge scale and help clean things up, or at least loosen it so you can pull it back out. You know, you want to wipe it off obviously before you put it back in the forge or start working on your anvil, and not necessarily working it cold, but it loosens things up so that you can brush it off. Probably a lot easier, and you know, even just a couple of those will help get rid of that forge scale and then start working at lower temperatures to help kind of start tidying up your forging, and bring that temperature of that blade back up so you can actually do some of those kind of successive planishing rounds of forging. Another tip about those brushes, those giant brushes that you're talking about, Jeff, I got mine from a cash and carry store, which is a wholesale food and restaurant store. And it's a grill brush. For the hot side, there's a giant grill brush with these giant bristles, nasty ass bristles. I've had mine for like 5 years and it's still basically brand new. They are a little, they're like $20 to start with, but that's one of those things that I'm glad I bought when I bought it, because it's been really useful, and it is really great for brushing off that hard scale. Like, in part of what those black, like what I've seen John and Duff and Cliff do is that they're not only are they brushing, they're like, they're impacting their material. They're like hitting it and brushing. They're like punching and brushing at the same time with that brush. And it's aggressive, and it was really interesting to see them do that stuff.
You can also get a wire cup for your right angle grinder. You don't have to like be, you know.
I try to stay away from my right angle grinder as much as possible.
Well, I mean, you know, I'm just saying that, you know, there's no, like, I back to the virtue thing. I mean, it's not like, you know, it's not like people are, you can get them. I mean, I have a wire cup on my wire brush all the time. And actually I use it a lot because it gives it, when, if you wire brush things while they're hot, you end up getting a nice finish too. You know, all the forge stuff I do, I always hit everything super hot with a wire brush, and it kind of chills everything out. It gets you, it's almost similar to like how you'd use like a Scotch-Brite belt, where it just kind of like chills everything out a little bit. Hmm. There you go.
Yeah.
There you go.
Well, what I like to do when I'm forging is a,
Go ahead.
Who am I,
go ahead.
Who am I,
keep going.
Who am I kidding?
Keep going. Oh man, I wanted to see how far you'd go with that one. I'd love to see that.
As far as I'd go, I think.
I was kind of hoping you were going to keep a little bit farther, but that's fine. You have a handle. You have a hammer from John Arion.
I do. I use that for driving in pins and stuff.
Wow. Oh my God. And aren't you going to still take a blacksmithing class coming up?
That was back in January. That was back in January. And
it was an axe making class.
It was axe. And it's time gone on top of me again. No way I can do it.
Craig, do you have a forge and an anvil or something to hit with?
I do.
Other than the hammer?
Yeah.
You do.
So I've got this little devil forge, which I used to use for my heat treating, and I've got this tiny little anvil, and I've got one of John's hammers. I just don't have the time. It's one of those things. I'd love to get into it more. And
sure. 100%.
Especially with my appearance on Forged in Fire coming up, you know, I think I need to...
I'm with you.
I'm gonna tell you one thing. You know who has one of the best knife makers, a guy I really like, but he's got the most fucked up anvil. It's Pariah Knives. I know you're listening. I know you're listening. He's got one of those ones. It's a blue with the nose cut off. He does these videos, and he always uses the worst anvil to cut off of. I love you, Chris. Chris, I'm just breaking your chops a little bit. I hope you do some more of those videos of you chopping wood off, whatever you're chopping off that little blue anvil. I love that little thing. Love Chris. If you're not following Pariah Knives, you're making a huge mistake, by the way.
This next one's for you, Craig.
For me. Go for it.
So this one's from Jace Alexander 8. He says, how big should steak knives be and what handle materials material to use? Blade type?
Oh, jeez. Well, let's start with handle materials. I mean, it's up to you. There's no definite answer to what handle material you'll use. But with regards to size and blade type, personally, I'd always use a stainless steel because nobody wants to get, you know, carbon all over their steak or any sort of table knife. Really, I'd use a stainless steel. With regards to size, you know, there's no hard and fast rules, but mine personally are sort of 6.5 inches. But here's the thing with steak knives: a lot of people don't realize
what's that in metric. Can you convert that?
Oh, geez, no, I don't. It's weird how some things I'll do in inches and some things I'll do in millimeters.
That's what I heard. I heard that. I heard that.
Depends what the weather's like.
Yeah, baby. The water's too cold. It's all millimeters.
But what I see a lot of people, if you just look at, you know, the hashtag steak knives, for example, on Instagram, you're going to see some beautiful knives, but you're going to see a lot that have got a really flat edge to it, almost as if they've taken a chef knife or a para knife and they've sort of shrunk them down. But take a look at, next time you're in a restaurant, take a look at somebody using a table knife. It's going to be up at about 45 degrees. All that cutting is done on the belly. So for a steak knife, I like it to be belly heavy, a lot of weight up front. And you know, I don't even sharpen the blade down towards the handle because that's not that the flat edge isn't being used to cut at all.
Right.
So quite often I won't even sharpen that bit. It's all about the belly. So yeah, make sure you get a nice big belly on it and you're going to make a decent steak knife.
That's one thing.
Do you serrate it?
Serrate it? Oh, Jesus, no. And okay. I had a meeting this week.
Wow, that was a serious answer.
With a restaurant, yeah.
God forbid.
And they talked about serrations, and it was no, just a simple no, because that won't cut meat, it'll just tear meat, and it'll tear the grain and the fibers of the meat, and it will, you know, change the taste of it. No serrations. I mean, I've looked into it. They ran about in the 50s, certain factories started putting serrations on things and calling them steak knives specifically for steak. Because they were using porcelain plates, and they were using not the cheap, not very good steels, not hardened very well, and they were dulling blades very, very quickly. So their way around that was not to make a better knife, was just to let's just put serrations on instead, and let's just tear the thing instead of cut it. So no, for me, definitely no serrations. Serrations are only used for crusty things, bread and that kind of thing.
I'm glad you mentioned that. I'm glad you mentioned that you really only need the first two and a half inches sharpened, and that's one of the things that when I made my design for what I like in a steak knife. My steak knives are closer to a butter knife, not really a butter knife. Then when they get too aggressive and they're too big, I don't like them as much, because you're not cutting all the time with a knife, with a steak knife. You're actually using it to scrape the food onto the fork. So yeah. I'm far more interested in something like, you know, my knives, I like the style of the Lyol style of knife, where it's almost like it's thinner and lighter in your hand. And you don't need to go all the way to the heel with the, you don't need to have all the way up to the heel sharp, because you're never going to get that part of the knife is never going to hit the plate. So I do like that. And one thing that I have heard is with the serrated knives is they destroy the plates. They totally destroy the plates, and there's really no way to kind of like, you know, sharpen them. So you end up with like a, you know, as the serrated steak knife gets duller and duller, you're just like you said, you're tearing that meat up, and then you're screwing up your plates.
Yeah, yeah. And you see more and more often now as well, it's particularly steaks being served on a slab of wood or, you know, that kind of thing. And yeah, a serration would just tear through that. And I think, you know, a slab of wood, for example, I think is very good for a steak, because you can use your steak knife and, yeah, you're not damaging that edge at all as you would with porcelain. But yeah, as long as you keep your boards clean, you're good.
I don't think I've ever been served a steak on a piece of wood.
Really?
No.
Very common. I get it.
Very probably common?
80% of the time I'm out and I'd have a steak, it would be on
80% of they serve you a steak on a piece of wood.
On a piece of wood. It's really, you've never seen that? You've never had that?
I've seen people use a cutting board and they cut the steak on the cutting board, but yeah. I've never been served a plank of wood with a steak on it.
Wow.
Nor have I ever been served with a steak with a side of fucking melted cheese.
It's camembert.
That's an old one, guy. That's an old joke. Craig likes to dip his steak in cheese. Hey, we don't have to go back to there. Let's go forward.
Let's go forward.
But that's good to me.
But how did you clean the wood? The wood's gonna like soak up all the blood and the juice.
Yeah, you gotta have a decent hardwood. And personally, if I'm doing them in the house, I'll use salt. You know, a coarse salt and water to clean
are
them.
Are you serving steak in your house on wood?
I am.
Really? So when you serve your wife a nice steak, she gets a plate of wood?
She does. She gets a plate of wood. Man,
it's high level over there at the Lockwood family. Lockwood family's getting some high level wood plates. Very artisanal. Did you make the plates?
Well, do you know what? Yes.
And get the fuck out of here!
No, seriously, you better get ready for this.
There was a spoon cracking.
No, we've got old. Our house is ancient, and we're doing a lot of renovations. So we pulled out the floorboards in quite a few of the rooms, and they're like 2-inch thick walnut. And these things are beautiful. So there's some areas where there's damage sent, but we've had to take the whole flooring out. So I've got lots of them. So I've started doing a few knife handles with it as well. Lovely.
So you've made plates out of the floorboards that people have been walking on for centuries?
Oh yes.
You flipping it over?
Yeah. History. How old is your house again? 200?
Oh no, from about 1600, we think.
Oh boy. So there's been centuries of horse shit and cow shit that's been smeared through the Nice. A little bit of foot and mouth disease over there in the
hospitals.
Yeah. No wonder your hair is so gray.
Should we go back to the questions? Should we go back to the questions?
Come on, man. All right, let's do it. Okay. Next one comes from Karam Knives. If you had to start your knife making journey over, what's the one thing you wish you could change? Good question, guys. What would you do differently?
I don't think I'd change. I mean, I've changed the way I do things constantly. So that is, you know, if something's not working, I'll change it. I'm not stuck in any sort of prescribed way of doing things. So I don't think there's anything I'd change, really. Maybe not sell those first sort of couple of hundred knives because they still haunt me to this day. But nothing I'd change.
Oh my God.
What would I change?
How are they haunting you? Are people sending them back to you?
No, but it's just a case.
Oh, they just.
I've talked about this in the past. It's like every time I do a knife or a batch of knives, they're so much better than the last ones. And I just wish, you know, I come from a software background. I used to make software and design software, that kind of thing. And we could always just send out updates.
A steak knife update.
Yeah, we could just send out an update. Yeah, just like, that's fixed. Nice. That's good. But, you know, these things are out there, and I know they're not as good as they could be. And that, yeah, it gets to me.
That's part of the journey, though. That's the way it is.
Yeah.
That's a good question. What would I change? I would have tried to focus on the business end earlier. I would have tried to like look at the big picture a little bit earlier. But other than that, I hate to live life with regrets. It's just like, you know, you can say I should have done this or I should have done that, but it's like doesn't really help the situation. Sure. So I don't think I would have made a whole lot of changes. I would have tried to focus a little bit more as a business earlier. But other than that, you know, it's a very interesting question. You get into little things. You know, you get into, I wish I didn't use, you know, such thick material early on. But other than that, I don't want to make any changes.
Yeah. I mean, I don't really have much else to add. I think I'm on board with what Jeff was saying. If anything, I mean, I love my customers, but I would probably have, maybe not allowed myself to get so backlogged, just because of the mounting pressure that I constantly am feeling, from the order list. Right. And it just gets worse when, you know, things there's, setbacks with builds and it just pushes everybody back. And so I take that really hard, even though my customers are very forgiving and very understanding. But that's probably the biggest thing I regret. Otherwise,
you know, to piggyback on that's a really good point. I think probably I would have focused more on making stuff to sell directly as opposed to taking on as many custom orders. I think that having a combination of the both would have been a little bit better early on, in terms of what you're saying, being able to kind of like have stuff to sell direct and then dealing with your custom orders as well. I think I probably would have tried to focus on less of, you know, just, you know, you're basically, it feels like you're taking a bucket and you're trying to take the water out of your boat that's like filling up with water. So I would probably focus on probably trying to make more stock stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, and I think the thing about customs that, you know, the people I had worked with, you know, working with Bob Kramer and then, you know, working alongside Dave Lish, you know, that's kind of the old school method of how custom knife making works is you take custom orders for a lot of custom makers. But I do wish that I had better understood other options and have had a little bit of different tiers or had made, you know, maybe a simpler production style knife, kind of like the bread and butter while I continue to work on doing my, you know, my custom stuff and, you know, really pushing my Damascus or all that kind of other stuff. So, but I think a lot of people see, it's easy to look at customs and say, oh, I have all such and such number of custom orders and almost kind of see it as a kind of a status symbol in a way, when the reality is like, it's not an awesome feeling it's nice to have the job security in a way, but once you've established a reputation for making quality knives that perform well in whatever task they're supposed to be doing, then you can kind of relax a little bit and ideally and just build whatever you want. But I think there's actually, like Jeff was saying, is to look at it from the more of a business perspective to start with and say, you know, let's make this a solid business before I can really start kind of fucking off and experimenting and playing around a little bit more. But I mean, ultimately, for me, there's nothing I can do about it. That's where I'm at. I'm where I'm at, and I just got to move forward.
Boom. All right.
Here we go. Let's do one more, and this is from Get Lost Knives. Hey, man, can I ask you a question? When it comes to full tang knives, how do you prevent the wood from expanding and releasing itself away from the tang? He says, do you use stabilized woods, do you use Corby bolts, or you just use a good all-round materials and epoxy? Thanks for the constant laughs and knowledge. I'm with you. It's a good question because there's so many ways to make a full tang knife. Jeff, why don't you kick us off?
Well, for me, it's interesting because I really have gotten to the point now where I really depend on stabilizing wood or using stabilized wood. And really, just the quick idea what stabilized wood is wood has holes in it and airspace. And what you do is if you have a house where you open the door and the window and it's a little humid, it gets stuck. And that's because it's expanding because of the moisture in the air. It's absorbing in those spaces and it swells the wood. So if you put the wood in a chamber and the chamber is a small chamber filled with resin, you hook it up to this very specific vacuum pump and it pumps out all the air in the chamber, pumps out all the air in the wood. And what it happens is after a certain amount of time, you see all the bubbles disappear. You've removed all the air pockets. You turn it off, and then wherever there is air is replaced by resin. And then it's baked off, and then that resin turns into like a polymer. And then all of a sudden, there's nowhere for water or any kind of liquids to kind of absorb. So that prevents warping, blah, blah, blah. I figured you needed that little blah, blah, blah. I love that. It really gives me a lot of... faith. I like stabilized wood in general. I like stabilizing my own wood too, because I can use, you know, local stuff. And I depend on Corby bolts. I think Corby bolts for me are awesome because all of a sudden you're mechanically fastening your material. You know, Corby bolts are basically two bolts. One's a nut end, and one's the threaded end. And then you get a special driver bit that makes a countersink perfectly to the size that you're using, and then you're mechanically fastening. Once you're all put together and it's all glued up, you just cut the heads off and you get this perfect finish. You're not peening material, you're not putting shock on your material, and then all of a sudden your epoxy is no longer, you don't have to, you're using the epoxy as a sealer. So I never get, there's never any expanding. The only time I've ever had a customer, a friend of mine, I made a knife for, this is back in the day, I used unstabilized walnut, and I told him to not, and I didn't use Corby's, I just used pins. And I told him to not put it in the dishwasher, and he brought it back. He's like, hey man, you think you could fix this? And it was just, you know, there's a huge gap. And I said, well, did you put it in the dishwasher? And he goes, I didn't put it in the dishwasher, but my wife did. And I was like, hey man, come on, man. I told you not to put it in the dishwasher. But I think that if I had used Corby's instead of pins, it probably, the wood probably wouldn't have slipped past the Corby bolts. It kind of, like, I think sometimes with the pins, when you see those that wood, it's slipping past, it's expanding, and it's a slipping past because there's nothing for the wood to be kind of held by. So But I also still have some knives that I made with unstabilized walnut, and I'm waiting to see what happens. And so far, so good.
Yeah, I think if it's a good hardwood, you can get away with it. If it's extremely hardwood, but with regards to stabilizing, yeah, I'd stabilize everything. If it is hard, it's very hard to stabilize. There's not going to be much air in there anyway, so you're not really going to get much of a stabilization. But what I also like about stabilizing wood is the finish that you get when you polish that up. Because it gives this sort of, it sort of plasticizes it a little bit, and it gives this lovely, lovely finish.
And for wood like oak, it changes the whole style. You know, it makes it all of a sudden, it doesn't make it so splintery and flaky.
Yeah, and you can add colors, that kind of stuff as well. But I mean, one of my first steak knives. So when I did this like a Kickstarter campaign, you know, some time back. One of the very first ones I've kept, and it actually lives in the dishwasher. So every time the dishwasher does a cycle, it's just there and it goes through the cycles. It's probably done a few hundred cycles.
Oh, man.
And those ones didn't have Corby bolts. They just had a mosaic pin and they just had a straight brass pin at the back. And that's still as good as the day that it was made. So yeah, stabilizing wood is massive. I think it's going to depend a lot on your epoxy as well. I spent quite a bit on epoxy. I'd love to take the time out and do some tests with different epoxies to see which holds better. But I'm now using Corby bolts on all of these sort of latest knives that I'm doing, and some that I'm doing will have decorative pins. So we've talked about this way of doing things in the past is cutting down your Corby bolt, actually putting a slot into it, because obviously once you cut it, that slot is gone. So putting your own slot in so you can tighten things up, but then I've still got a gap of about 5 millimeters. So then I can use a decorative pin, which I'll just take the slither of. And, you know, if you're making a pin which is 6 inches, you all of a sudden you've got a pin that'll do a hell of a lot of knives. And I'm epoxying that into that. So you've got a hidden Corby bolt, but you can still get the decorative pin. So if the epoxy were to fail, which thankfully it hasn't yet on any of my knives, if the epoxy were to fail, that pin would pop out, but the bolt would still be there because that's got the mechanical fixing. But yeah, definitely stabilize woods. Don't use soft woods that haven't been stabilized because they're going to split, they're going to warp, they're going to go all over the place.
I have learned recently that there is epoxy that kind of deteriorates under exposure to moisture. And I didn't know that. I just assumed that all epoxies were basically the same and that moisture wouldn't be an issue. But I have found, I've learned that there are some epoxies that do kind of break down when with prolonged exposure to moisture. Yeah. So I'd be careful that, especially if you're any knife that's going to be exposed to a lot of moisture, which potentially is basically any knife, especially like the oils and like this sweat from your hand or whatever, being washed or hand washing or exposed to tomato juices or whatever you're cutting up. Try to make sure you're using an epoxy that's waterproof.
Yeah. And a lot of the epoxies are made for boat builders. So I won't say any brands, but if you Google it, boat building epoxy, you're going to find some. And that tends to be the brands that I'd use.
See, and that's the thing. Actually, I looked West Systems. I'm just going to say it. West Systems. Yeah. They make an epoxy and they clearly state on there, do not allow to get wet, which is hilarious because a lot of the stuff they do is for marine work. So I wonder, like, where the fuck is that? Why are they even making that epoxy? And
which epoxy
it?
That's not G-Flex or the 105 or 106, no. Is it?
I can't remember which one it was, but I would double check the info.
So just make sure you.
Yeah,
make
I was
sure
looking
look.
At some of them.
Make sure you see. Make sure you see what you got.
I would say just one last note about helping to prevent the material from expanding on top of using stabilized materials is also I've still had even stabilized woods move on me. And so trying to figure out how to close up the surface as well on top of it being stabilized, doing like a hardening oil of some sort, like a tongue oil, consecutive coats or something like that, or a nice hard furniture wax or something like that, that will help close up any potential areas where moisture still could get into your material and cause kind of expansion and contraction, and that will help kind of reduce that considerably as well.
Yeah. And also back to just flattening those scales first. Get them as flat as possible, because if they're not 100% flat, or the flattest they could possibly be, you're going to be putting stress on there. So obviously when you drill your holes, they're going to be perpendicular to the flatness. If it's not completely flat, you're going to be putting some stress on that wood, so it's more likely to crack if dropped. So yeah, back to sort of making sure things are super, super flat.
So keep your flat wood lubed up, sounds like
to
me.
That's the way.
Get that hard wood in good shape.
You like making those dick jokes.
I didn't say that. That you did. I just said keep your wood flat and hard.
Innuendous.
There's no innuendous here at all. I'm just talking about handle material.
Jeff likes to put his wood into a vacuum chamber.
Hey man, just because you guys make that jump, I can't blame me. I'm here for. Listen, I'm talking about handle material. You're talking about dicks. Come on, man. What happened?
Jesus.
What happened?
Okay. Sorry, sweetheart.
Yeah, Sarah, that wasn't me, man. That was your old man right there. Oh, Lord have mercy. All right, so now, guess what? I'm back from New Jersey. I'm not back from New Jersey, you stupid asshole. I'm back from Spain. And you know what came back when I got back here in the shop? I'm in the shop right now. I got a package from the New Jersey Steel Baron. They just water jetted all my Bandito knives. And I'm telling you what, I put it up to my my template that I gave them. It's exact. So if New Jersey Steel Baron, not only do they sell great steel, and you can go to New Jersey, their website, and they're still working on it. So, you know, that's the way it is. You can buy material from them, but they'll also do water jet services. So if you give them a template of what you want, where the holes are, blah, blah, blah. I physically handed him a template and he got, Pete got it perfectly 100% right. So they'll do water jet services. They'll do your steel for you. All their steel is marked and certified in regards to they stand behind it and where it came from. And it's an awesome way to sponsor, to support a small business. And New Jersey Steel Baron's fantastic. That's where I buy my steel. That's where I get any water jet services done. And there we are, New Jersey Steel Baron.
Website coming soon.
Well, we'll see. I'm with you.
Craig's Community Showcase.
It's that part of the show where we like to give a shout out to somebody or a product or something that we really respect and admire. And I'm just going to jump straight into it. So mine is Clement Knives. Now, I first spoke to these probably about a year ago. They actually invited me down to their shop. They knew that I was in London for a meeting and they're based in London. They said, come on over. And unfortunately, time got against me again and I couldn't make it. But a few times they've popped up over the last year. So I talked last week about recycled handles and this recycling that I'm doing for a bunch of handles. So I'm on the Precious Plastics website and doing a bit of research on recycling plastics. And they pop up as somebody who uses this process. So so they're doing that already. I think they're taking old plastic out of the Thames, the River Thames in London. They're taking it out of the Thames and they're repurposing it as knife handles, which is amazing. And they've actually recommended me for some work as well. So I had an email from them saying, look, they've been asked to do this work. They're a bit snowed under and they've recommended me for it. So that's what community is all about, looking out for each other. So a big thanks to Clement Knives, and they're Clement Knives on Instagram.
There you go.
Who have you got, Mareko?
Love it. I want to give some love to my buddy Robert Burns. I actually can't remember if we may have already given him a shout out for the community showcase, but if not, and you don't follow him, you got to go check him out. He's on Instagram as Wilderness Ironworks. He is now in Massachusetts. He's originally from Pennsylvania, but he is a phenomenal knife maker. He's super talented. He does really great work. He's very creative. He's young. He's like 26 years old. And he's doing really great work that's very inspirational. And again, very creative, and he's doing stuff that, you know, I don't really see a lot of other people doing. And it's just really cool to see his flair in his work and taking things that are kind of, and he does a little bit more kind of traditional ABS style knife, but he definitely puts his own spin on it and gives it a little bit more character than you would normally see. And so, or I guess outside of the norm in a good way. So, and he's doing a lot of really cool stuff with Mosaic Damascus recently. So definitely go give him a follow. Wilderness Ironworks. It's Robert Burns. He's a good guy.
There you go. Well, I'm going to give a lot of love to Florentine Kitchen Knives. And if you're not following Florentine, and I know we've mentioned him before, I know he had a whole episode, but I don't care. I'm telling you this. Tomer Botner and his wife, Noam Blumenthal, are extraordinary people, and Florentine Kitchen Knives is a very, very good resource in regards to what you should be looking at in terms of the total package. I think that his knives, I've seen them up close. I helped build a few. there are the total package in regards to fit and finish, design, the design element. He set himself apart from a lot of knife companies. He's a super, super savvy guy, really smart. I've learned a pile from him. His handles are beautiful, and they're beautiful, and you get this customization with the handles, and they look great. And I just like, I can't tell you enough how he is an inspiration to me in regards to this business. Thank you, Craig, for introducing me to, I never knew Tomer before this podcast. So it's just, you can't stress enough how this guy represents the total package in terms of creating a product for his customers and his customer service, his packaging, his everything is, you know, he's really kind of figured all the little details out. And I'm just, you know, I'm very honored to know him, and he's someone I look up to.
And you can wear the hell out of a cape.
Hey, he's got some, hey, listen, he's got some nice Dutch aprons. I was envious of his beautiful style. He's got good style. He's Tomer's.
What's a Dutch apron?
I get some of these aprons from the Dutch. I don't know. He gets these Dutch. I don't know. It wasn't like a thing. It was like a top hat. It was like a, you know, he's got these. I was like, where'd you get those nice aprons? Holland. I got the Dutch. And I'm like, all right, they're awesome. So got a good style to him. Smart guy. Cruises around on a motorized scooter, looking good all the time. Tomer Botner, man. High
good
level.
Guy.
I started saying, you know, maybe I needed a motorized scooter. So I got home. Hillary's just like, maybe you could go to your shop's only 2 miles away, get a motorized scooter. Thank God the United States doesn't allow, or New York State doesn't allow motorized scooters on the streets, because it would be problems all over the place. And I'm a big guy.
Really?
I'd be a big guy. I'm a big guy. I shouldn't be on one of those goddamn things. I look ridiculous. Like a clown. But it was.
What do you mean they don't allow? Do we have scooters?
You're
on
not
the street?
Listen.
Like a Vespa?
No, no, no. Like there are these, not like that kind of scooter. Number two, I'd look even stupider on one of those. But
you're talking about like a Rascal?
No, 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 not a Rascal. I'd look even stupider on that. That's probably gonna be the next thing I get. But it's
it's more age appropriate.
All right, there you go. Keep them coming in. Keep them coming in. But it's this. They're like kick scooters. You know, they're like what kids have, like those Razor scooters. But they got these motors on them, and all over Barcelona, people were on these scooters, and he didn't kick once. It had incredible power, and he looked good getting to work. And he's, you know, smart. He didn't need a car in Barcelona. So everybody's
wait. So were you riding along with?
No,
him?
I was on a city bike. I was on a city bike, and I tell you what, they in Barcelona, they had some assisted city bikes. So you kick once, and it gives you a little extra, it's got a little engine on the back, and it gives you a little bit of a boost. It's a great way to get around, but thank God they don't have those ones in New York. Otherwise, New Yorkers would be driving through, you know, windows, and they'd be like getting ass over tea kettle. But yeah, New York State's just like, hey, listen, man, you motherfuckers are going to be on the highways with those things. We don't want you on there. So there's no none of that shit over here. It'll play.
Do we have beefs?
Yeah, damn right.
Where's the beef? The beef.
This is the part of the episode where we talk shit and air some of our grievances a little bit of our own festivus here that we call What's the Beef. Craig is going to kick us off with what he's beefing about.
Yeah, planes, beef? Trains, and automobiles. So we talked about this earlier, I've had a month or so of just constant travelling and fed up of just bad, bad travel. So let's start with trains. Trains never on time. So if you're in a city, if you're in London, for example, you can just hop on the tubes and that's fine. As soon as you get outside, you've got to get, you know, your normal train, which you've got a schedule, which they never keep to. They're always closing down things and diverting. The biggest beef I've got with trains is there's no bins. There's no bin on a train. So if you've got a 3-hour journey, you're going to take something to eat, and you need somewhere to put all your crap. There's no bin. So you get to the station, so you take it out. There's no bins in any of the stations because they're worried people will put bombs and shit in there. So you just walk around with this bag of rubbish then, and you've just paid a fortune for this travel too. And they won't even put a bin in.
So you're talking a garbage can.
Garbage man,
garbage can.
Yes. So that means that trains are just full of garbage because people are just like, well, I've got nowhere to put it. I've literally just got to leave it here. And they're not cleaned. They're disgusting. They're disgusting. And as we pointed out earlier, these are costing three or four times what you'd pay for a flight. So trains, sort your shit out. You're my beef this week.
Trains, sort your shit out, trains. Ah, I love that. I love that ending. God, look.
Maraca, what's your beef?
What can you do?
My biggest beef right now is with sleep. I'm no early 40s gentleman with twin babies, but I have not woken up from a well-rested night in what seems like a long fucking time.
Welcome to my world.
Yeah.
I got your solution. I got your solution. Go ahead.
It's draining on me. So I need to figure something out because I can't, like, sleep is very, I think it's important for everybody, but I do not operate well when I'm not getting enough sleep and I'm crabby as fuck. You know, people get hangry and shit like that. I can go all fucking day without eating food. But if I don't get enough sleep, I'm the biggest piece of shit, angry little motherfucker you ever met.
I'm going to solve your problem right now. I'm going to solve your problem. Go ahead.
Yeah, let's hear it.
Go ahead. Finish up.
A solution.
You need a little.
No, that's it. I just need to get some good Z's.
You know what?
That's what
you
want
to get some good Z's?
And I'm pissed that I'm
go
not
get
getting
yourself
them.
A little puff puff. Have a little puff puff before you go to bed. A little bit of weed. And you're going to sleep like a fucking baby. Trust me.
Kids,
trust
we do not
me.
Recommend drug use on this show.
I didn't say anything about that. Don't do that. Oh, yeah. By the
well,
way,
I am in Washington State.
Don't do it.
It's legal in Washington State. So if you're Washington, you're a grown adult of legal age. You make your own call.
Yeah,
but I've actually heard more and more studies about how substances like that can actually really start fucking with your sleep. And...
All right.
Not help. They'll help you. You won't get as good a sleep as you
all
could
right.
without it.
That's
but
with you.
I have heard of that.
I've heard of it too. All right, listen. Here's my beef. My beef is when you're on an airplane and the plane lands. Don't clap.
Oh Jesus! Yeah.
Don't clap. This is not when you get on a plane, it's not rolling the dice if you were to survive. The chances of an airplane crash are very, very low. It's safer to fly than it is to be in a car. Sometimes you get on a plane, it's usually from Florida. I get on a plane, it's a long ride, and we land, and it's bumpy. I'm not a great flyer, I don't enjoy flying. But for God's sakes, act like you've been there before. Please, act like you've been there before. Don't clap and thank God and thank the pilot for not killing us all. It makes you look dumb. They're not supposed to crash. So don't start clapping. It sounds so stupid. It makes me feel like, God damn it. What do you think? What do you think? This is a shot in the dark. This is going to work or not? Have you ever been on one of the planes? Would they clap?
Unless the stewardesses clap, then you know that it is worthy of a clap.
Have you ever been on one of those planes where somebody they land and people start clapping?
Oh yeah, yeah,
oh,
plenty.
Yeah, the first time I ever heard it, I was like, "What the fuck's going on? Did I miss something?"
Yeah. Performance of Thank God We're
entertainer
Alive.
Entertainer on board somewhere.
It's just like, come on, guys. I'm not a good flyer though. The older I get, the worse I am. I grip the thing. I turbulence. I can't. Get comfortable. I don't enjoy it. I don't enjoy flying at all. But for God's sakes, I'm not going to, you know, oh, thank God, you know, thank Jesus. Hi, everybody. Thank everybody. That pilot. Oh, the pilot saved our lives. No. The pilot did his job or her job. Don't clap.
I was just going to say, you know what a good solution
is? I certainly do. Go ahead.
You get yourself one of those edible gummies, weed gummies, and I don't know if it's legal in New York, but eat one of those before you get to the airport. Right. By the time you get through TSA, you're going to be feeling pretty good.
Hey, children, don't do that. Listen to me. If you want to see a crazed maniac on a plane, feed me some of that before I go on. I will never go on a plane.
with that, because I don't, not that I do anymore, but when I did,
you don't hide
I
up.
Was like, I'm the kind of guy, like, I need to unplug the phones back when you had a really had a house phone. And I like to crawl into a sock drawer. I am not going on a plane with other people for a long period of time, up to my back gills and, you know, that stuff. So I'm more along the lines of just kind of like grind my teeth and pray for the, you know, hope for the best. And, you know, just don't clap. Don't clap, please. P.S. Wow. P.S. If you're on a long flight, why do the flight attendants wake you up if you want a sandwich? Why do they wake you up if you're sound asleep? It's like, listen, the steward, the airlines now are so smart, they put TVs in the back of the seats. So it's great because it's like, I don't have to deal with your bullshit anymore. The flight attendants are like, this is perfect. You watch your TV and you're not going to give me any shit. So why would you poke the bear and wake these people up? I was next to a guy, dead asleep. She woke him up to see if he wanted some orange juice. And she's like, no, I don't want any fucking orange juice. I was dead asleep.
Thank you for waking me.
Jesus Christ. And now he's irritated. I'm sitting next to this fucking guy. She like lit him on fire, basically. And then I got to deal with this fucking guy.
They've got to have fun some way, haven't they? That's got to be the worst job ever. Can you imagine like all these people going off on holiday and they just don't give a shit about you?
You're
just there to serve them. Ugh, be the worst.
Tomer, by the way, hooked me up with the flights, and he got me bulkhead seats on the way back. Shout out to Tomer, the best of all time. And I had a sweatshirt on the floor because there's, you know, if you're on the bulkhead, there's nowhere to put your shit. This flight attendant said to me, "Sir, you have to put that above your head." And I'm like, "What are you talking about? It's just a sweatshirt." He's like, "You can't have that on the floor." I'm like, "It's just a sweatshirt." So you were having this argument about it's not gonna fly off and like hit somebody in the head, you know, landing, it's a sweatshirt. So I ended up having to put it in my lap, but it was very much along the lines of I would hate to have that job where I gotta argue with an asshole like me and say, "Sir, can you just put your sweatshirt in the goddamn top? You're driving me crazy here." So maybe I should eat some edible gummies before I go on. I'll be a little bit more relaxed. And clap at the end. Thank God we're home.
So there we've had trains, planes, and sleep as our beefs this week.
And
nice.
Pains.
Nice.
Yeah.
So that's a show. That's a show. Episode 75. We're done. Thank you again for listening. Remember, we've got our forum at forum.knifetalk.net. If you've got any questions you want answered by our listeners, and we shall speak to you next week.